Hey there, this is Rish. It's weird that I haven't gotten more episodes out in this last month than I have. Everybody has more free time on their hands cooped up right now. So this episode was originally going to be a Patreon address, but about halfway through, I realized I'd been going on a while and I thought, oh, you know what? This might be a Rish Outcast. So I recorded myself introducing it both ways. Somebody on Facebook just, I think it was yesterday, said they had posted and they're like, guys, can we please talk about something else other than COVID-19 on our goddamn podcasts? I'm so sick of it. And I was surprised by that because, well, okay, what it reminds me of is there was a Far Side cartoon years ago, and it takes place in a bar, like a sailor's bar, and there are these two sailors sitting at a table, and one of them has like a peg leg, and the other one has a hook for a hand, and they're looking, and over at the bar is a sailor whose head is missing and has been replaced by a peg, and there's all these people gathered around to hear the headless sailor tell his tale, and one of the sailors says to the other, it's just like, oh, there's Captain Latham again. I can only guess what story he's telling everybody. That's what it reminds me of. This is the most significant thing to happen in years. It's affecting practically everybody on the planet. It's unprecedented. It's world-changing. And so, yeah, I would be surprised if any podcaster didn't do an episode about it. Anyhow, enjoy. If you can, if you're that one guy, then skip this episode by all means. Or, you know, skip to the 30-minute mark when I start talking about something else. But that's going to be way less interesting than a worldwide pandemic. Next week, or whenever I get out the next episode, it'll be something unrelated. Something from before all this happened. And the week after that, something from before all this happened. But right now, you know, this is what's going on, kids. Good night. Hey there, folks. This is Rish Outfield. I mean, obviously, right? Unless you listen to these things on random, on some kind of device, in which case it's useful, right? To say, hey, folks, this is Rish Outfield, and you are listening to me talk, a Rish Outcast episode.
The coronavirus edition.
Well, see, you see, I don't know that I liked that voice that I did just then. But what's done is done. I can't edit these things. Actually, I do edit them, which I think prevents me from putting out as many as I could. When I had Abigail Hilton on the show, she said that she does a daily podcast, and that still just floors me. There are very few things that floor me anymore. How crappy the robot is in Logan's Run. How I never don't cry at the end of It's a Wonderful Life. How sunsets, particularly beautiful sunsets, are magnificent to me, even though I've seen 1,000 of them. Have to have seen more than 1,000, right? Let's see, what else? I mentioned recently in my blog that I did the math, and if I heard the Police's Every Breath You Take once a week since it's come out, and I've probably heard it more than that, but let's say once a week, I've heard it over 1,500 times. I guess that floors me too, but I was just going to say the fact that I don't change the channel when I hear it floors me. What in the? Oh, she does a podcast every single day. I'd like to do that sometime. If this gets much worse, the everybody stay at home thing, right now I'm just in the car by myself going for a drive. It's probably not super responsible, but we're not at like lockdown status or anything like that here yet. Some states, you know, like California is, I know that Washington is. There are some states where you're not supposed to go outside unless it's, what's the word? Is it essential? Like you have to go get money from the ATM, or you have to go to the liquor store, or you have to get groceries. or you have to go to the dog fights. You know, these are things that you can't put off, and so there's exemptions for that. But apparently the police will cite you if you're just out doing what I'm doing. Oh, no, officer, I have a podcast. It has over 4 listeners. I guess I'm digressing. I don't know how long this thing is going to go. And nobody really knows. I mean, there have been people who have speculated, and they are people in authority. And then other people say, don't listen to that. You know, people say China. So there's disinformation out there. And then I think that there is a pressure to not panic people. And then maybe there's a pressure to throw softballs on this so that it doesn't tank the stock market again, or I don't know. I mean, it's already cost billions of dollars just in this country. And we don't know if a month from now it's going to be worse, if a month from now it's going to be better. And so eventually the laws of probability say that I'll be on lockdown and I can't do what I'm doing right now, which is I got in the car. The kids are out of school. So I live with a 12-year-old, a 9-year-old, and a 2-year-old. And they're just... it's just gasoline and road flares when you get all those 3 cooped up in a house all day. They don't go outside. They don't go to school. My nephew used to at least, you know, go out and play basketball until he was exhausted with his friends. And now, you know, the friends are being told, well, you can't share a basketball. You can't play that close to another kid. No open mouth kissing. And so they're cooped up in the house and they're very loud and rambunctious, and tensions run high, and I just feel sometimes like I got to get out. I have, this year in 2020, I've been very, what's the word, where I look at myself quite a bit. I'm very aware of the state of my life and the solitude that I have. And then when this quarantine thing started happening, I saw the real difference between me and young people, or me and very social people. You know, there are people who live for parties, concerts, gigs, bars, going out and having barbecues. And I don't have any of that stuff in my life. The last time I went to a bar was with my brother-in-law. He went saying, hey, do you want to go to the karaoke bar on Friday? And I was just like, oh, yeah, of course. Because I love karaoke. It's up there with The Sunset. And some, gosh, what was her name? There was a chick that was in a bunch of, like, the Hammer horror movies named, like, Veronica Carlton or something like that. Carlson? Carlson, I think. Anyway, so I went to the karaoke bar with him. And I didn't realize that the bar part was way more interesting for him than the other part. He didn't put his name in to sing. He just went there to drink while I sang. But at one of these bars, it's just first come, first serve. And sometimes it'll be a half hour. Sometimes it'll be an hour in between the times that you get up and sing. That's why it's so good to have friends, I've heard, because all of you can get together and sing on each other's songs and stand up and sing along and encourage your friends. And it makes the lulls in between your songs go by so much shorter. And I have had the privilege of going and doing karaoke with friends before. And I love it. Because it's a social occasion, but it's a social occasion in which I shine. Like going to a dance or going to, I can't think of another thing, I'm sorry, maybe a bar. A non-karaoke bar, that's just fuel for me to feel awkward and unattractive and unpopular. But at a karaoke bar, I have confidence in my singing ability. Whether or not that's misplaced, that's a subject for another time. But I get up there and I give it my all, and, you know, I feel good when I'm doing that, and I enjoy singing along and cheering for the people around me. And there are few social occasions where I shine. But I guess the reason I started saying this is that I hear of these people that have a lot of friends or people who are attractive, and it's really, really hard for them not to be able to go places, you know, and show off their outfits or get drinks bought for them by men, or just being able to cut loose and dance and, you know, the stuff. I guess when I was younger, I did do some of that. Now, granted, I think I've had one drink bought for me in my whole life, and it was that girl Marie that I talked about in the I Feel Young episode who bought me a drink, and I was just like, you're buying me a drink? And she's like, yeah, how does it feel? How do you like it now, scum? And I was like, wow, thank you. How did I get on this? But okay, sorry. When I was a teenager, I had a couple of friends that liked to go to the discotheques, you know, to the dance club kind of thing. And I had this crappy job, and I've talked about it before. Because I was a teenager and because I was low on the totem pole, I was always given the worst shifts. Like, it would be like the Thursday night 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. shift, followed by the Friday night 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. shift. But every once in a while I would get together, and I had this friend that had been in the army. His name was Ben, and he loved to go to this club where it was just, they would just play his kind of music. It was like new wave music. Oh, I think it probably had different levels. And I'm sure I'm explaining to you how the sun rises in the morning and then it sets on the other side of the world at night. But they'd have different levels that would play different kinds of music. Like there would be a country level or a maybe like a rap hip hop level kind of thing. But where we would go, you know, it would be 80s music, or it would be, you know, the pop music that was on the radio at the time. And it was really fun to do this with a group of friends because, you know, we were too young to drink in those days. And there wasn't the societal pressure as a teenager of, you know, you've gone to this place to hopefully meet someone who will go out with you or give you their number or go home with you. When I was in Los Angeles, that's what bars and clubs, dance clubs were for, and it was very hard. Well, also I had fewer friends there, although I did all right for how asocial I am. I feel like I did all right in at least making a few friends. And one of the things that's neat is if you go out with the same group of people enough times, you get to know the friends of your friends. And I, again, I'm telling you stuff you already know, but you start to call their friends your friends. And now I'm feeling so sorry for myself. It is, again, staggering. Great. I have this ability. Wow. The point I was trying to make is that for young people, this has been really, really hard to not be able to go do these social things, to not be able to swap spit with strangers. And I may come across as very cynical or very judgmental or say, you know, F millennials or whatever when I say these sorts of things. But as I've said multiple times in 2020, I am trying to be more empathetic. I am trying to understand how other people might feel, and I get it that this is really difficult for them, and that there are some young people who have said, you know what, no, enough. I don't care about this anymore. If I got sick, if I got the coronavirus, I would be fine. And it's time. I've actually heard somebody say, it's time for the boomers to all die. And maybe this will help it along. It was only one person that I heard say this, and I couldn't tell if they were joking or not. So I both sympathize, and I find it hard to sympathize with young people who are really, really having difficulty with this. But at the same time, I have been fired from jobs. I know what you're saying. Every job, Rish. Yeah, technically no, but pretty close. I have been fired from jobs where all my friends were people that I worked with. And it was a huge kick to the nuts to not be able to go to work and see my friends anymore. And I know that a lot of young people are probably out of work or on, you know, take all your sick leave, take all your vacation right now. And so that would be hard too, because socializing is not easy for, I'm not going to say for most people, but I'm going to say for a lot of people. And so there's that. And church has been canceled too. And I understand that for a lot of people, church is a social occasion. I get that. School for me was social. When I was in high school or when I was in college, you know. And I miss that. I've thought, I don't know, 140 times about just taking a class at the, you know, the local college, whether it's a writing class or a kickboxing class or a art class or something like that, just so I can be around people again and have a little bit of structure, you know, a place that you have to go every other day or twice a week or whatever it is. So I guess I am trying to say I feel you for the people that are just going out of their minds. Hopefully you can understand how I feel, though. Every day I have to get in the car and go to the park or go somewhere and write, because the kids just drive me out of my mind. And my sister and I have yelled at each other. When I see my mom sometimes, you know, I don't want to see her. She's afraid of the virus, and you know, she's got the TV on all day. Now, luckily, I had gone to the library about a month ago. It might even have been longer ago. And I asked the librarian, I said, my mom likes medical thrillers. She likes Robin Cook. She liked Crichton when he used to do that. There was somebody else, like a Michael Palmer or somebody like that. What do you have that's that? And I got like 16 books from the library for her, and I took them over to her. And she still has most of those, although, you know, she burned through a few that first time before this started to happen. So that it was really cool that she has all these books that I brought her. The library closed without warning. I think it was open on Friday, and then on Friday afternoon or night, we got an email that says the library is going to be closed starting tomorrow. I wish that there had been a day that I could have gone and just gotten a ton more books, like 50 more books, but mostly for her, because I have two outstanding books from the library, and even if this thing goes two more months, I won't have read them. Sorry, the thing I was saying is I understand feeling cooped up, and I understand wanting to go somewhere, and if you're in a city that's on lockdown, that's got to be really, really hard, and my thoughts are with you. At the same time, I'm a podcaster. I wonder about people that are YouTube personalities or podcasters who are on lockdown, if suddenly their productivity goes way, way up. Because it totally should. Jenny Nicholson is one of those people that anything she puts out, I will watch. Even if I don't agree with it, I will watch it and get something out of it. I think she is fantastic. And she got it. She got the coronavirus. And she did a post that said that, you know, not a video. And then nothing since then. And I wonder if, you know, she's sick or how that works. But it just seems to me that I could continue to podcast, or if I were a YouTube person that just, you know, is a talking head, I could do that more than I already do. This is the first episode I am recording since all of this has happened. Marshall Latham and I did sit down last week and talk about this. He put it out there unedited, and it sounded fine, I think, although maybe he did edit it, and that's why it sounded fine. But I've only ever done that once or twice in my, if you call this a career, but in my stretch since 2008 of being a podcaster, I have only ever put out two episodes that were not edited. And it's just because I hate how many times in a half hour I say, and I hate the long stretches. And then when I'm driving like this for a Rish Outcast, sometimes things are just super noisy. Or you'll run over a roll bar, you know, something like that, and I'll be like, ugh. And usually I'll catch it and re-deliver the line that I just, you know, the sentence that I just gave. But sometimes I can't. I forget. And what do? I am ashamed sometimes when I'm editing the Rish Outcast at how bad the audio quality is. And there's an upcoming episode of The Twilight Groan that we did on Christmas night. I think we did most of our episodes on Christmas because my niece spent the night. Everybody was tired because the kids had gotten up so early in the morning and they all wanted to go to sleep at like 7. And so my niece and I stayed up, and I'd say we did six episodes of The Twilight Zone and did six episodes of the podcast about it before she's like, okay, I'm done. But one of the ones that we did, the two-year-old was running around and making noise, and somebody had given him, I don't know if it's a xylophone, but it's the, you know, the little pieces of tin, and you have a drumstick and you hit them and they go ding, 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 ding. And he was doing that during our recording session, and the microphone picked it all up. And when I edited that episode, I was ashamed. I thought somebody somewhere is going to say, nope, unsubscribe, or whatever you say, cancel culture thing. Okay, boomer. And they wouldn't listen anymore. But there's nothing I could do. I've seen my niece once in February and once in March. Now, luckily, in March, she was willing to sit down with me and do another episode of The Twilight Groan. But we don't have time to redo that episode. And who knows if we'll have a chance to do more episodes. She was, it's not called Skyping. I think it's called FaceTiming. She was doing that with my nephew today. She's at home with her boyfriend. I guess they're probably not practicing social distancing. But I considered saying, hey, Cathexis, this is the name that she chose for herself to be her online persona. And it's an actual word, and it's a really cool word that has a definition where you're just like, oh, well, that's a situation I didn't know we had a word for. And every episode that we do of Twilight Groan, I ask her, would you like to explain to the audience where your name comes from? And I always hope that she'll say, yes, actually, it's a word that means this, because I've forgotten what it means. But I considered saying, hey, Cathexis, do you want to do an episode? Like, both of us can watch an episode of The Twilight Zone on Netflix, and then we can call each other and do a Twilight Groan right, like immediately after. But I don't know that she has anything that will record. I mean, maybe her phone has the voice memo function, in which case, I guess I'll ask her if that's something that she would be interested in doing. Here's the thing, by the time this episode comes out, because I imagine I'll put this out either at the beginning of April or later, it's going to be a moot point. Because either she will have said, yes, we can do that, and we will have done it. Or she'll say, oh, you know, my phone doesn't have that thing. Or, you know, I really don't want to do those anymore. I would rather be with my boyfriend. Yeah, I nearly said do there. But there's that. I guess what I was trying to say is that with time on our hands, time on my hands, could be time spent with you, laughing like children, living like lovers, rolling like thunder under the covers. Yeah, I just said that after talking about my niece. I not so wise. If ever an episode needed to be edited, if people are on lockdown, then I'm just thinking, you know, there's more time for podcasting. One last little thing. So I went to the grocery store just now. That's where I stopped. Usually when I go, I ask like my sister if she needs anything. My mom gave me a list last time I went. But they've implemented this thing, which is old hat for you guys, but brand new here, of when the store first opens in the morning. It's the grocery store. I think they do it at Walmart. They do it at Target. The first hour, or maybe it's 2 hours of the day, is set aside for senior citizens. And my mom was really excited yesterday, which was Monday, because it meant she could go. She went to Macy's, she went to Walmart, I don't know where else she went, but she was able to do some shopping. And I didn't get it. I asked her, I was like, Ma, you're so afraid of catching this thing, and you're always watching the news and looking at the stats, and nobody knows the death toll up to the minute except for you. Why would you do this? And she said, to give me a chance to get out of the house, to be able to go and buy some stuff and feel normal for a little while. And I was just like, okay, I guess I get that too. She said that, you know, they opened the doors and they had wiped everything down and put out all sorts of new stuff. And the senior citizens were able to go there and shop with impunity, knowing that like no kids have touched things, that no filthy millennials had put their taint on, you know, their pasta sauce or whatever. And I guess that's cool. I think that's kind of neat. When I went to Costco last week with my sister, there was somebody whose job it was to wipe down the cart before I went in, and then another person whose job it was to wipe down the cart when it came out of Costco. It may seem like overkill. In a way, it did. But it also enables two people to have jobs. And then I think it makes people feel more secure. They feel a little bit more safe. And, you know, if this continues to go south, I can see people saying, well, you know, that's what you get when you want people to feel safe. You know, we had X number of deaths, or we had the infection. You know what I mean by infection? People were infected. People got the virus that didn't have to get the virus because we wanted people to be able to shop again, or, you know, I don't know. At the same time, we keep hearing, if nothing really comes of this, it's not this epidemic that changes the landscape forever, there will be people that say, you know, it was all for nothing, it was an overreaction. But it's better that people say that than that people always say, what if we had tackled it earlier? I mean, I'm a World War II buff, and I'm always talking to people about how reluctant America was to get into the war, and how that was almost a deal breaker for FDR's last election. You know, he had to assure the American people that he was not going to plunge America into that European war. Otherwise, he would not have been president for another term. And yet, knowing what we know now, we should have gotten into that earlier. You know, how many lives would have been saved if we hadn't stayed out of the war? There are a million factors in something like that, a world war. But hindsight, it's just so easy. And when I hear the attitude of your average citizen in 1940 or 39 or even 41, all the way up to November of 41, it's hard to get my head around that people wouldn't want to be involved, or they wouldn't want to make a difference. They wouldn't want to stop what was going on there. But that's all hindsight. That's all knowing what we found. You know what I mean? Like when my grandfather was there for D-Day and went into Germany, and the things that he saw, he would never talk about. But he saw the camps, and I remember, I think it was my grandma telling a story of one of the guys in my grandpa's unit. He saw this starving child, and he gave him a candy bar, like a Hershey bar from his rations, you know. And the kid couldn't, his body was not used to that kind of food or richness or whatever. And the kid was throwing up, as a little boy, I almost feel like I interpreted the story as the candy bar killed that little boy. And I hope that that's not the case. I hope that that's just a morbid interpretation that I had as a 10-year-old or 11-year-old when my grandma told that story. But it's possible that this act of kindness toward a starving child killed the child. And when we hear these stories, of course we wish that we had gotten into the war earlier, that we had cared more, quicker. But life is so complicated at the time, and you don't always have all the details. And boy, I feel like I've talked about this before. I've talked about World War II a bunch of times on here because it's just one of the things that's endlessly interesting to me. But Anne Frank, I think about Anne Frank all the time and how unfair it is what happened to her, but at the same time, how important she is to our understanding of that situation, how she is the poster child for the Holocaust, and if she hadn't had this vibrant personality, if she hadn't written the diary, if the diary hadn't survived, if her father hadn't survived the camps to go back and collect all this stuff and publish it, our empathy toward that situation would be so much the less. Well, you know, as Forrest Gump would say, that's all I have to say about that. All right, so I guess now I'd like to talk a little bit about 2020, the good side of 2020. How productive I have been as a writer and as a podcaster. I've put out more content in 2020 than I probably did in 2018 or 2017, the whole year. And I don't need to go into it again of just how I found a muse, I found inspiration, I found a midlife crisis. I wanted to work harder, I wanted to leave some kind of mark that I had been here. I exercised every single day. I've started getting better at the exercise, in fact. So when I first started jogging, I would do about a half a mile, sometimes three quarters of a mile if I felt ambitious. Then there were a couple of days when I just, you know, had frustration or the opposite of frustration, and I did a whole mile. Then I extended, either last week or the week before, I started to extend it to be a mile and a half. And yesterday I actually was able to go the whole mile and a half without stopping. And to my surprise, at the end of the last couple blocks of my jog, I sped up. Instead of how it usually is, where it's just like, oh my goodness, can I make it? Okay, only two more blocks. Okay, only one more block. And yet when I look at myself in the mirror, I am still fat. But oh well. I talked to Big Anklevich about that, and he said, yeah, you're never going to lose weight from exercise alone. And he told me of his thing, this obsession with just eating meat. And Big is interesting. Because for a while there, he had this idea of intermittent fasting, you know, just like eating every other day. And that was going to solve all the world's problems. And to each their own. If he found something that works for him, that's great. But yes, I had been aware of the Spanish flu epidemic that hit in 1918 for years now. And I believe, and I could totally be wrong, but who cares, that the word decimate came from that plague. The Spanish flu wiped out 1 in 10 people. That's when you decimate a population, that's what happens. But in the last 50, 60 years, decimate has come to mean you wipe out everybody. And anytime I hear decimate now, it bothers me because it's wrong. But now everybody talks about the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918 because it's suddenly relevant again. And we don't want that to happen again a century later.
here are the things that have improved since those days. Here are the things that we have learned since those days. And then conversely, here are the things that make it spread faster and make it harder to eradicate in these days than in those days. I mean, obviously, travel is 1,000 times faster and more convenient and cheaper in 2020 than it was in 1918. But yes, the history books will look back on 2020 as the COVID-19 time, you know, the coronavirus epidemic, pandemic, if you will, and time will tell how severe that will be, how long-lasting that will be, how bad that will be in the history books. And yet, 2020 has been this year that I've written so much and I've been so inspired and felt so much. And so yeah, I guess you take the good, you take the bad, you take them both, and there you have the facts of life. You know, it takes a lot to get them right. And so at the time of this recording, I've written over 50 days in a row, and that's more than 80,000 words in this stretch since I started on the 1st of February. And not all of those 80,000 words are going to go anywhere or be part of stories that get finished, but a good deal have. And right now I'm working on a Dead and Breakfast story called Meet the New Clerk, same as the old clerk. And I've so enjoyed writing this series. I can't think of anything in the 30 years I've been writing as a capital R writer. I don't deserve a capital R. But in the 30 years that I've been writing, I've never enjoyed anything as much as I enjoy these stories. In 2015, I wrote the first story in this series called True Ghost Encounter, and it was intended to kick off maybe an anthology. Here is the premise. Here is a story that sums everything up, puts down a couple of ground rules, and now we'll see where it goes from here. And where it went from there was nowhere. But in 2019, I started thinking about this premise again, and I started to write this story called Touching the Other Side, about a phony psychic who goes to this bed and breakfast where one day a year, the 2nd of July, every tenant, every guest of the bed and breakfast gets visited by a ghost. And I gave up on that story about halfway through. This would have been the summertime. And I had had this idea in my head of a new employee is hired at the bed and breakfast, and we follow her daily routine and then the discovery that the place is haunted. And that story became The Night Clerk. And I started writing that and I came up with these characters. The main character in that one is Natalie Whitmore. And she's a pretty young woman who is hired because she's pretty to man the front desk. And she meets Mason Bradley, who is the other night clerk. So they alternate nights, and then on Friday nights and Saturday nights, there are two night clerks. Because the bed and breakfast basically does all of its business on Friday and Saturdays. Mason Bradley is kind of a goofy, backward geek, but he's got a very good attitude. Now, Mason is based on me, except for he's sort of gotten away from me. And there's this guy that I see a few times a month, and his name is Tanner, and he is just, he's skinny and he's gangly and he's just always got a good attitude. He's a positive person. And I've started to base Mason a little bit more on him. And that's been interesting. And then Natalie is based on, well, initially she was based on somebody that I met that was the desk clerk at a place. And she had been a model. And she had been placed there because she was so attractive. The idea was, you know, you put somebody like that out front and people will be happy to come in. And I never really got to know Macy very well, but I met a girl named Natalie, and decided to name the character after her. And, well, I really, really enjoyed the story, and it went very, very well. It was supposed to be the Halloween episode last year, 2019 Halloween episode, and I never put it out. I guess I'll put it out this Halloween, but I don't know that I care anymore about that. I could just put it out for, you know, April or something like that. It doesn't have to be a Halloween episode. But it's all about Natalie Whitmore and her discovery that the place is haunted. And it introduced these two characters, Natalie and Mason. And I dug it. I dug these two characters and I dug their dynamic. And I went back and I finished Touching the Other Side, incorporating Mason and Natalie into that story. Whereas initially it wasn't going to involve, well, those characters didn't exist when I started writing the story. Once I discovered the joy of writing two stories back to back that both took place on the same night and involved the same characters, the floodgates just started to pour out. The next story I wrote after that was called The Old Man and Me, and it was a backstory for Mason Bradley, how he discovered that the bed and breakfast was haunted. And he tells Natalie the story in The Night Clerk, but he leaves out certain details because it's super private to him. And then I just thought, I want to tell that story, and I want to include those details. And in writing The Old Man and Me, I planted a couple of seeds that could be picked up later. The ghost says, you're going to need this information one day. And he tells him this thing. And I thought, okay, I'm going to eventually write a story, if I keep doing these, where the ghost's advice comes in handy. After that, I wrote a story called Three-Time Visitor. And this one was my attempt to write a sexy story set in the Noble Oaks bed and breakfast. And there's a man, I think his name is Alonzo, although that sure sounds wrong now. Alonzo, and he comes to the bed and breakfast on a day that it's not the 2nd of July. And we discover that the place is still haunted on certain days of the year. It's a super, super haunted house. But of course, on the 2nd of July, it becomes the most haunted place on the face of the earth. He meets the ghost of a woman who died, and he becomes interested in her. Yeah, I mean, you would. She's the ghost of a beautiful woman that appears in his room and communicates to him that he needs to come back on the 2nd of July. And when he does, he's able to interact with her physically. And she tells him, you know, you need to do this thing for me. This is my situation. This is why I'm a ghost. And so he has a mission to accomplish. And then when he's accomplished it, he will come back to the bed and breakfast. Hence the title, Three-Time Visitor, is because he comes back three times. And this story continues beyond the 2nd of July, and it goes on through the rest of the year. And in my mind, I thought, okay, so one thing that's going to be great is he's going to come here at the end of the year, and Natalie and Mason are going to be an item. They're going to be together. And I was so tickled by that because I loved that idea. Mason falls in love with Natalie like the second he meets her. And she only somewhat tolerates him. By the end of The Night Clerk, I think she learns to appreciate that this is a good guy. And his positive attitude becomes infectious once she too discovers that there are ghosts, that this is a special place that they work. And so in Three-Time Visitor, Alonzo was going to come back the third time, and Natalie and Mason are together. But when I wrote that scene, the characters wouldn't let me. They had become closer from working together so long and from her getting to know him, sympathizing with him, discovering he's a new guy, but she's just not interested. And that really surprised me because I am the writer, ostensibly. And the characters wouldn't let me get these two characters together. And I'm upset by that, because in The Old Man and Me, I thought, okay, well, maybe Mason can use this advice that the ghost gave him to get Natalie to fall in love with him. And I still haven't written that story yet. But I think that I will write that one day. He's going to say what the ghost told him, and Natalie's not going to get it at all. And he'll be like, but I remembered it word for word. Please, this was supposed to fix everything. And real life has crept in and sort of affected the way that I write these things, the attitudes of the characters. And when I wrote Night Clerk, I wasn't really sure how Natalie was going to, how caustic a personality she was going to have. Because this girl, Macy, that I based her on when I first conceived of her, I never really got to know her very well. She was pretty, and that was it. She was very business-focused. You know, she was there to do a job. She was not there to chat. She was not there to be your friend. In and out kind of thing. She was a receptionist. And I thought about that, and I thought, you know, if you're as pretty as Macy is, maybe that's hard. Maybe that is a difficulty in life that I can't understand. Is if you are nice to people, they fall in love with you, or they think, oh, well, she obviously likes me. Now I can get my hands on her, you know? The character of Natalie has surprised me a few times, because there have been times, especially in Three-Time Visitor, when she's not very nice, particularly to Mason. And Alonzo thinks, you know, I don't know that I like this girl much at all. And then there are other times when she's just so warm, and I like that about the character, and I like that about writing this series, because people aren't just one thing. And the thing with Mason is, you know, he was introduced to be optimistic and bright and selfless, and yet what happens when your boss starts to dislike you and wants you to not work there anymore? How do you maintain that positive attitude? What happens if you work with the most beautiful girl in the world and you have fallen for her and she's made it clear that she's never going to like you back? Is it still fun to work with the most beautiful girl in the world? I think as I continue to write these stories, Mason probably will become darker and less positive, and Natalie will probably become sweeter and more empathetic, and I find that really interesting. I wrote a story called Fatherless Child that was sort of a one-off that's not really all that involved with the rest of the story. It takes place that same night, July 2nd, that Night Clerk and Touching the Other Side culminate in. And there was just a woman that Natalie had given the last room to in the Night Clerk, and I decided to write a story about her. And then after that, I wrote Never Let Him Go, which is all about, as I've mentioned, Mrs. Bice, the owner of the bed and breakfast, decides that she doesn't like Mason anymore, and she doesn't want Mason to work there anymore. And part of that is that Mason becomes increasingly distracted once Natalie is hired, and he was probably the perfect employee before she came on, because he loves working there, and he's a people person, and he's really dedicated to that job. I think I wrote a line in something where he said, you know, I want to work here for the rest of my life. And then this girl is hired and he falls for her, and suddenly he cares about something else more than the bed and breakfast, and maybe he gets sloppy. I don't know. I've never established what it is that Mrs. Bice dislikes so much about Mason. But that story is all about her deciding it's time for him to go. It's time for me to find somebody to replace him. And the ghosts
they start to push back on that. They don't want him to leave. Mason has a connection to the ghosts that none of the other employees have. They will call him sometimes. And I just really enjoyed that idea. And along the lines of that story, Natalie starts, she goes over onto his side and starts to dislike Mrs. Bice and her obsession with getting rid of Mason, which I think brings the two of them closer. Then I wrote a story called The Last Friday in December. And this is one that is very dear to my heart, because in Three-Time Visitor, I mentioned a little detail of that the ghosts called Mason up on the phone one time and said, you need to make sure that you are working on the 28th of December because somebody is going to need you. And I don't remember how many times the ghosts call. Maybe it's just the one time, but Mason tells Natalie about it and they decide they're going to figure out where they're needed and they're going to do some good. And it's important enough that the ghosts told them about it. And that story culminates in, like I said, last Friday in December, Mason is in a car accident. And the idea in my head is, even though it's never spelled out in the story, is that there are forces of good that want Mason there to save the life of someone. And then there are forces of ill that say, no, no, you guys can't do that. And so Mason goes off the road, crashes his car, he gets hurt, but he still comes into work. And that story, more than all the rest, I like Night Clerk a lot, but I think Last Friday in December is my favorite of all those stories. And it's the two of them bonding even more, Natalie and Mason. And this girl comes in, her name is Rowan. And I had in my mind, we're going to introduce this other character. Ever since I wrote Three-Time Visitor, or came up with that idea of you need to be here. And this girl is going to be very important in Mason's life. And I don't know if it's they're going to fall in love. I don't know that they're going to get married. I don't know if maybe Rowan is going to come work at the bed and breakfast too. I don't know. I've not written any stories with her in them except for that one. And she's really only there at the end. Then I wrote a story that's a little bit less connected that I was calling Who You Gonna Call? And it's I'm thinking I'm going to call it Sucker for Mystery now, because in the very, very first story, the True Ghost Encounter story, I had these guys asking all the people that have rooms for the night if they can take their room, if they can buy their room. I think they offer like $1,000 to the main character, who's a guy who... He works for a website. He writes True Ghost Encounters, a website. And these guys are paranormal investigators. They have a TV show. And so I had just planted that as, like I said, here's a possible story that someone can tell, thinking that other people might want to write in my sandbox. And Sucker for Mystery is all about them discovering the rumors or the secret to the Noble Oaks Bed and Breakfast and trying to talk to our main characters, who are Natalie, Mason, Mrs. Bice, and by this point, a new clerk, a day clerk called Michelle. And she was the clerk in the very first story that I wrote. And then I basically abandoned her once I came up with Natalie and Mason, these two characters that I love. But I have reintroduced her into the body of work, and I've focused quite a bit on her in the story that I'm writing right now, which is Meet the New Clerk, same as the old clerk. And the fun of that story is that we meet Michelle, we find out she used to work at the bed and breakfast, but she quit abruptly after something happened, and she hasn't been back since. And while Mrs. Bice is attempting to fire Mason, she puts out a call for desk clerks, and Michelle decides that she's going to come back, but only if she can work days. She's afraid to work nights because of what had happened 3 years ago. And I started writing this story blind, not knowing where the story was going to go and not knowing what it was that scared Michelle away. Then, yesterday, I figured out what I wanted it to be. And basically, this story will be her coming back to work and getting to know these people and then facing her fears at the end of the story. I guess I've talked to you for a good long time, for almost a half an hour, about this series. And it's amazed me to be able to write all of these stories. I also started to write one that will take place later. I don't know. I started to write one about, that involved David Bowie. And I'm not ready to write that just yet, because it will take place a couple of years later. True Ghost Encounter takes place a year after Night Clerk and Touching the Other Side. The Old Man and Me takes place a year before Night Clerk and Touching the Other Side. And this story, the David Bowie one, probably takes place 2 years after Night Clerk and Touching the Other Side. And I'm just not ready to go there yet, because I don't know who will be still there or what will still be going on. And I don't know who will still be alive. One of my main characters probably needs to be a ghost for this story to work. I don't know. It doesn't have to take place on that day, though, because David Bowie doesn't have to show up in person. That's something that I hadn't really established yet. Okay, so that one could take place anytime. We'll see where that goes. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention another story called Till Death Do Us Meet. And this is a story that Marshall Latham wrote, set at the Noble Oaks Bed and Breakfast. And in True Ghost Encounter, there was a honeymooning couple that showed up, and they didn't know that the place was haunted. And the other people in the lobby, who have all gathered to talk about their experiences, the people in the lobby all know that this place is haunted. I think most of them have been there before. By the time True Ghost Encounter takes place, I think there are a bunch of new rooms. They like built up on the building, and the places where like the staff spent the night have all been moved into like mobiles outside. And so I guess there could be a lot more rooms than the 12 rooms that there are in the first 7 or 8 stories. But anyway, Marshall wrote this story about this honeymooning couple, and he included references to Michelle, including the fact that she had burns on the side of her neck, and I don't know if it was her face or not. And I was just like, wow, that is an interesting detail, Marshall. Huh. Where did you come up with that? And he's just like, no, you wrote that. Michelle is the clerk in your story. And I thought, oh no, what am I going to do? How am I going to do this? But True Ghost Encounter was always intended to take place after the Night Clerk, because the way True Ghost Encounter starts is that there's a YouTube video and a woman is telling about her trip to the Noble Oaks Bed and Breakfast and the ghost that she encountered, and that she found out that there's a ghost there every year for everybody that stays. And in Night Clerk, I had that woman spending the night at Noble Oaks, and she calls Natalie on the phone from her room and says, I've just had this most amazing experience. So I always intended for those two stories to be a year apart. So it's fine that Michelle is the clerk in True Ghost Encounter. We'll see how many more stories in this series I end up writing, or if I write none. And Big Anklevich says that, you know, I need to put them all out as like an audiobook. And he's right. And my fear is that the stories end up being a little too samey if you put that many of them together in an anthology. But I could put like 5 stories together. Clerk, Touching the Other Side, Fatherless Child, Three-Time Visitor, Never Let Him Go, something like that. Those 5 stories together, or maybe 6 or 7 stories. And then once I get more stories written, I could do a second anthology that includes True Ghost Encounter and Sucker for Mystery and Last Sunday, Thursday in November, Last Friday in December, or Meet the New Clerk. You know, these are possibilities for the future. And it would be nice to be able to make money from these stories. I'm writing them because I love it. I can't stop writing them. I keep being inspired. I keep enjoying writing this stuff. Just to have references to other stories, and then in each story to plant a seed that could be harvested in a future story. That is unlike anything I've ever experienced as a writer. It's like writing a television series, I guess. I guess I was falling asleep just then. So that should tell us what we should be done. Marshall's story, Till Death Do We Meet, is pretty long, and it's a different story than I ever would have written. And that's what I wanted from the beginning, is I wanted other people's perspectives, other people's emphases, you know, things that you care about, things that scare you, things that fascinate you. He was the first one to do that. And I was going to run his story on the Rish Outcast, but it sounded like he would be more comfortable if we ran it on Journey In 2. But maybe I'll be there and we'll talk all about it. And I can't wait. It'll be great. Now, obviously, this episode will be superfluous when that happens, or who knows. But yeah, I just wanted to talk about it. This has been such a productive part of my life. And I've written other stories in between those. Not just the Dead and Breakfast stories. I finished a Ben Parks story just, you know, a couple weeks back. And I really ought to get on that, try and publish that. Because people like those. Anyhow, I think I'm going to leave you. I've been sitting in this car for half an hour and the sun is starting to bake down. And I feel the sweat at my temples. And yeah, if I'm sweating, then you got to be sweating too. So thank you for listening. This has been Rish Outfield. Good night.
Well, well, we've reached the end of another nigh unto interminable episode of the Rish Outcast. Now that the end has come, you may forget how painful it was and that it was touch and go there for a while. I am here to remind you of what we've all suffered together. However, I am also here to remind you that The Outcast is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. Download the file, listen to it, copy it, share it, and bring it up as a cautionary tale to frighten young ones into minding their manners. But do not change the files or attempt to sell them, or the worm will turn on you. And oh, that worm, how it hungers. Also hungry is Rish Outfield himself. He has an ever-dwindling Patreon support fund that helps motivate him to put out episodes and calms the beast raging inside him. You can donate per episode by visiting www.patreon.com/RishOutfield. Or you can tip him through PayPal via his blog. Thanks to Gino Moretto for his generous work on the logo. Until next time, I have been Fake Sean Connery, and you have been warned.
I'm going to do Our House just for fun, because I heard it playing at Walmart today, and I want to know the lyrics to that one bit.
Father wears his Sunday best. Mother's tired, she needs a rest. The kids are playing up downstairs. Sister's sighing in her sleep.
Brother's got a date to keep, he can't hang around. Our house, in the middle of our street. Our house, in the middle of our house, it has a crowd. There's always something happening, and it's usually quite loud. Our mum, she's so house proud. Nothing ever slows her down, and a mess is not allowed. Our house, in the middle of our street. Our house, in the middle of our house. It's in the middle of our street. Our house, in the middle of our. Father gets up late for work, and mother has to iron his shirt. Then she sends the kids to school, sees them off with a small kiss. She's the one they're going to miss in lots of ways. Big Sean, there's that part in our house. I never know what they're saying. So the day away. Could you do that part for me? Our house, in the middle of our street. Our house, in the middle of a. I remember way back then when everything was true, and when we would have such a very good time, such a fine time, such a happy time. Is that how it goes? And I remember how we'd play, simply waste the day away. Then we'd say nothing would come between us to dream us. That's good. Father wears his Sunday best. Mother's tired, she needs a rest. The kids are playing up downstairs. Sister's sighing in her sleep. Brother's got a date to keep, he can't hang around. Our house, in the middle of our street. Our house, in the middle of our house. In the middle of our street. Our house, in the middle of our house. Was a castle and a keep. Our house, in the. That was where we used to sleep. Oh my gosh, let's do Total Eclipse of the Heart again. You don't want to do it. You'll cry. I may.